I think we can all agree it's been a rough spring with COVID-19 taking over our lives. You may know someone who's sick or who's lost a loved one or their livelihood or any number of awful things. But as all this goes down, we don't always know what to say or do for someone who's hurting, let alone asking for the help we might need ourselves. My guest, Kelsey Crow, wrote a book and founded a whole community to help us help each other. We spoke in 2017, and I thought now would be a good time to bring back our conversation. I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point, with stories of how women rise up.
I had a friend in graduate school who was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I didn't know what to say or do. And so I did what a lot of people do, which is just figure, well, if she wants me to connect with her around it, she'll reach out.
That's Dr. Kelsey Crow talking about her friend Heidi.
And I knew with Heidi that she, along with so many other people who go through these really horrible situations, are surrounded by a community that cares and just doesn't know whether it's appropriate to show up.
For Kelsey, her friend Heidi's illness also brought up something that she'd been living with for years.
And somehow, it came to me that I cannot contribute to the same kind of isolation of others in their time of need as I experienced in mine.
Kelsey's referring to the heart-wrenching and lonely loss of her mom to mental illness, her only parent and family, when Kelsey was in her 20s. When she turned 40, she herself was diagnosed with breast cancer. Between her friend Heidi, her mom, and her own health scare, it made her realize that most of us really don't know what to do when we're experiencing grief or how to reach out when something awful happens to others. So Kelsey actually shifted her career focus in order to give herself the time to understand what grieving people want and what they don't. She surveyed 900 people about their experiences with grief, founded Help Each Other Out to provide empathy boot camps, and wrote a book about what she learned. The title of her book sums it up. There is no good card for this. What to say and do when life is scary, awful, and unfair to people you love. It was written with and illustrated by Emily McDowell, who you might also know as the creator of Empathy Cards. Kelsey learned a lot through her research.
I mean, I was just like hitting myself against the wall too. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. So many things that I didn't realize I was doing wrong.
We'll be right back. And we're back. My guest is Dr. Kelsey Crow, and her book is There Is No Good Card for This. There's a little phrase in here that this is whiskey for the wounded, yeah. Not chicken soup for the soul, mm-hmm. Which was so pervasive, I don't know, a decade, 15 years
yes.
ago. So tell me about that approach.
Sure, sure. And there's some curse words in there, which most people appreciate, some don't. But I'm a New Yorker, and swearing, for example, is like a nervous tic for me. So I just also believe that this topic has been treated so sensitively with such delicate perspectives and phrasings when the experience itself of being scared, feeling that life is unfair, that it's awful, is actually filled with a lot of curse words.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to keep those buried. You know, I just wanted the swearing to be part of the book. And Whiskey for the Wounded is saying, yes, this really sucks. And what we're doing together is serious, hard, hopefully sometimes good stuff, and a little more intense maybe than just chicken soup.
Why did you write this book?
Yeah, well, and also, if I may, I'll just say, too, that, you know, it does cover a lot of topics. And when I was initially trying to sell the proposal, a lot of publishers said, well, it's not cancer. It's not death. No one wants to read a book that covers all of these issues. People want something really specific. And I said, well, you know, if my neighbor has cancer, I don't know if I'm going to go read a whole book on how to support a friend with cancer. So I wanted something that was more of a life manual than just a cancer manual. So the fact that I so explicitly covered many difficult times was not an easy pill for publishers to swallow at first. But now I think the public really has. It's been doing really well. And I think the way people describe it is it's just like a handbook for life. And that's what I wanted. But actually, what's interesting is the topic that got me, some of the topics that are in the book have happened to me, but the main impetus behind doing this book is not a topic in the book, which is around mental illness. So I had a friend, and this does not involve mental illness, this part of the story, but I had a friend in graduate school who was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I didn't know what to say or do. And I did not feel good about how paralyzed I felt about reaching out. I knew that I had a problem, and I figured that other people had a problem. And while doing a dissertation on a very different topic and then proceeding into a career in public policy, I did a lot of research around what works and what doesn't to get people through a difficult time. And a lot of people have that experience of not connecting with somebody they care about who's in a difficult time, and then they move on from that. They kind of get over that, and I couldn't get over it. And that's where I realized why this mission, which I worked so hard to manifest on the margins of just normal life, was so compelling for me. And that is the story around mental illness. My mother, who was my only parent and my only family member. She had no siblings, so I had no aunts or uncles, no cousins. And my grandparents had passed away. She raised me. We were very, very close. And she also had schizophrenia. And when I was 19, she stopped taking her psychotropic medication that made our relationship manageable. And then when I was 23, her paranoia, it got so significant that she changed the locks, she changed her telephone number, and I lost her completely, despite my efforts to try to connect. And that kind of loss, where there's a loss of the mind, we don't have a way to memorialize that person or to honor that relationship that you have. Certainly to explicitly say there's been a death of some kind. And so I experienced the loss of my entire but very small family pretty much alone without recognition. So there were no cards. There were no invitations for the holidays. There was no record of people's memory of my mom when she was well. And clearly, the absence of all of those things in that scenario was a very, like, amplified version of what so many of us go through in our difficult time.
In that situation for you, you were an adult, so not a child, so it wasn't necessarily something that someone would think that it was an imperative to help you through or make sure you had a place to live or something to eat or, you know, enough money to sustain yourself, right? So for your situation with your mom, the fact that you felt so alone, do you think that it's because you weren't sure how to ask for help?
Oh, sure. So, you know, and I was 19, you know, when she went off her meds, and a lot of pretty intense things happened until those 3 years and when she really just ended things. And I had these needs, like wanting an invitation for the holidays, and there were some financial needs that I had that I struggled around. But asking for help was certainly not really on the table, whether because I didn't know what I needed. For example, you know, I couldn't have said, I'd really love to raid somebody's fridge without having to ask. you know, I didn't recognize that certain comfort and familiarity that you feel in at home that I really didn't have when visiting anywhere else other than my own house. And that sense that you have to charm and earn your keep to get an invitation for the holidays, that you can't just not be having a good year and still belong somewhere. You do feel when you're without family at all that you have to earn your place. And certainly the neediness that comes about with intense loss of any kind can cause then a lot of shame. You don't want to be that needy person. You want to be that likable, funny, giving person. So I really didn't share my needs with anyone. And I didn't, again, have much awareness of them to begin with. I buried them, definitely. And probably more aware of shame than I was of my needs. I was just aware of this sense that something was pretty wrong with me. And I think I was broken.
I feel like I need to go raid the whiskey bar for you right now.
Why? Noon, is that appropriate?
One of the things that you do say in the book is to be specific in your offer of help. So would now be a good time for me to pour you a shot.
I see that stash of bourbon underneath your desk.
But this is, I have to say, like, I mean, what an emotional event for you, and the fact that it is still, you know, so strong within you after all of these years. You know, as someone, now I'm going to start to cry, as someone who has just recently lost their own parent, I keep wondering, like, when will I get over
this? Over?
And now?
I'm sorry. I'm certainly not helping you see some rosy light at the end of the tunnel.
I'm going to get out two shot glasses. But as far as, you know, as far as what you took away from that experience and then thinking about this woman that you were in grad school with and not knowing how to reach out to her, how do you see those two things as being connected?
Well, I think, you know, what I realized, you know, I didn't admit my mother's loss for 15 years. So I didn't talk about it. No one knew. Except for my very close friends. So,
because she had not passed away.
She had not passed away, but she wasn't in my life. So when people would say, you know, were you going back east, or when I was in the Peace Corps, was I going, you know, going back, quote unquote, home, and I didn't know where I'd be going back to, all that stuff. I just sort of pretended like I had something. And I think that at some point I realized that, yes, it was very, very hard for me to ask for help. And I was like, well, why the fuck should I be the one learning to ask for help when I'm feeling so crappy? And why would I be expecting my friend Heidi to ask for help? Like, that's actually not squaring up. And instead of self-help books that were just proliferating beyond belief, you know, in the early 2000s, how you can basically help yourself, I said, well, we need a help each other book. We need how do we help each other so that we're not waiting to be asked for that empowered individual who feels ready to ask for help. And so that's where I wanted to go with it, is how to make it easier to show up when you want to show up, not to make people feel to guilt them into showing up, but to help them do what they think is right to do. That's how that squares up.
And when you do these workshops and you are you doing the workshops with people who are trying to do a better job of giving empathy, or with people who are trying to cope with their own grief around one awful thing or another?
It's both. So say, for example, in a hospital setting, I can do it for professionals who want to learn how to care better. But in fact, you know, many of them have been working in the field for a long time. But they really, really respond to the very practical nature of the work that I do. And also, some of it dives deep into how they are as a human being, not as a professional. And so there's that kind of person that just wants to, in a way, get better at their job. But what they really respond to in the workshop is just feeling better as a human. Then there's also, say, in the hospital setting, for caregivers or for patients. And in that workshop, we talk about both sides of the coin, both what it is to offer help and how can we feel more confident in doing that. And also, the other side of that is, in order to feel more confident in what we give and trusting the value of what we give, we also have to trust what we receive. And that's actually very hard to do when you're in your very dark time.
Wait, tell me more about what you mean by that.
So if you're in your dark well, you may want support that looks a certain way. You may want your best friend to call you every day. You may want your husband to straddle you with affection. You may want your mom to just listen to you. These are the expectations that you have. And when they don't meet those expectations, you're disappointed. What's very possibly happening, however, is they are giving you something else. But you're in such a hole that you can't see it. And letting go of what we expect to receive and noticing what is being given really helps us appreciate and value the community that we have. And the more that we can actually notice what is being given instead of focusing on what we're not getting, the easier we are to give to. Because people fear disappointing us. And so with that, learning how to receive, learning what is being given, understanding that people have different strengths and that they have gifts that are authentic to them, that they can give more easily. Recognizing what those gifts are and being able to ask those of people is a real important skill.
So what would be an example of that?
So say you have a friend and you love her for her sense of humor. And then you're in a really dark time. And she's not such a good listener. And you feel pretty pissed off about it. And you just want to be able to talk about it. And a lot of times people will rearrange their address book based on those failed expectations.
So less time with the jokey friend.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if, however, you can appreciate the levity that you need, that they want lightness for you, that they want humor for you, and this is how they can give to you, can help you appreciate that. And especially then, say you do just need some fresh air into the situation and you want to get out of cancer land or you want to stop hating your ex or you want whatever it is, call upon that friend and ask them, like, tell them, please just make me laugh. And then that neighbor who you always thought was just a little too earnest and you couldn't quite share your cynical side with or never got your ironic jokes. If you just want to be listened to, maybe try talking to them. So that's what that means.
Mm. So let's talk about the giver and, you know, and how they can determine whether, you know, being that jokey person or that earnest person is what the person they're trying to help actually needs. Mm-hmm. Because you give so many examples of things in this book that sound so familiar because they're trying to be helpful, but really having completely the opposite effect. Could you share some examples of those typical situations that some of us may not even be aware that we have committed?
Right. And that's usually in the conversation part of providing support.
Yeah.
So, and just to say, like, so much of what we can do doesn't actually require talking about it. There's so many sweet gestures that show that we notice and ways that we can be there for people. And so if you are afraid of don'ts in conversation, there are other avenues for you that we talk about in the book. But being able to talk with somebody about what they're going through is really, really valuable. And the basic don'ts, I will say, The one thing that really came across in the data, and that as a Sagittarius from New York was really hard for me to believe, is that people don't want your opinion.
No. What?
So I was like, no, surely that could not my opinion. My opinion's got to be a good opinion.
Right. Well, and it's also, it's easy to just to have your rational mind take over. Oh, well, this is how you solve the problem.
Yes, yes.
From what I've read.
Yes. And so behind that, behind like giving our opinion is this feeling that we have to fix somebody's problem. And in so much of our life, we are paid to fix problems and we want to fix problems. And that's how we get our sense of competency and our value. But when it comes to someone sharing real difficult news or emotionally fraught feelings, trying to then fix it is the worst thing that you can do. And you may not recognize that you're even trying to fix someone's problem. So some of the specifics that I talk about in the book are, for example, trying to give a sunny side to the situation, helping somebody see it in a different light. Oh, it could be worse. Oh, and anything that begins with at least, zip.
Total no-no.
It's such a no-no. It's such a no-no. So fixing it by trying to adjust somebody's perspective on the situation by saying things like at least or comparing their situation to someone else's situation. Also, it's important if we have gone through something similar to share that, because there can be a sense there's so much isolation and shame with what you've gone through. So for sure, you can share a little bit about what you've been through, but we don't even feel it. But 10 minutes later, you're like, oh my God, did I just talk all about myself when I was trying to comfort you? So be super mindful to not take all the space in a conversation and talk about you. So if you've gone through something similar, like, I'm sorry, I lost my mom 10 years ago, switch. How are you doing? And don't go into the details about your experience unless that person isn't in crisis and they're asking you. So trying to fix it, trying to relate, and then oversharing on your part are two big ones.
You also have a section called Please Never Say This, so at least being among them. I mean, you yourself have experienced breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're on the receiving side of it. And can I ask, what are some things that people said to you that you were like, please?
Yeah.
I don't want to hear that again.
Well, and it all, again, goes back to trying to fix it. So giving advice, right? Some kind of treatment that you should be trying, some sort of fourth opinion. My uncle is a retired oncologist in Kansas. I really think you should talk to him. Lots of advice, questions around. I was very surprised by this because I have a fairly secular group of friends. I was very surprised by how many people asked about my religious practice. Anything that suggested a theory behind why I got cancer, my nutrition, what I ate, and being in the Bay Area, you tend to be a fairly healthy eater, and any questions that tried to find out the source of why this happened to me, suggesting that I brought it upon myself. And I have in the book these non-listening styles that I think are very, very useful. And those include the sage, who's always trying to offer a wise perspective on your situation. And one woman, for example, diagnosed with cancer, said to that effect, my uncle said, I see this as a sign of unresolved issues between you and your mother. Fuck you.
Not helpful.
Mm-hmm, not helpful. So the sage, the optimist, who says, well, at least it's not pancreatic cancer. Or at least it's only stage 3 and so on. There's also the doomsayer, and I tend to be the doomsayer. And in my workshops and in the book, we say we all have one of these non-listening tendencies. So there's none of us that don't have one of these reactions, and mine is the doomsayer. And the doomsayer that would say to me with breast cancer was bringing up other people that had died of cancer, breast cancer.
Thank you very little.
Yeah. So, and I never, you know, being a sort of a pessimist by nature. That was another one of those things from my research was like, oh, my God, that does not feel good to hear horror stories. I, in sharing that, thought I was relating to sort of the gravity of the situation and honoring how serious this was. But it's actually, even for a pessimist like me, hearing those stories was horrible. So those are some examples, pessimism, optimism, offering a sage perspective. The epidemiologist is the person that does ask a lot of fact-finding questions, and those tend to make someone feel like you're trying to find out how I brought this upon myself, aren't you? Or else those fact-finding questions really derail the conversation into what that person wants to talk about. So lots of don'ts, lots.
This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guest is Dr. Kelsey Crow, and we're talking about her book, There Is No Good Card for This. We'll be right back. I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. I'm talking with Dr. Kelsey Crow about her book, There Is No Good Card for This. Well, let's talk about some of the things that you can do and ways that you can talk with someone who's in a position of grieving or loss or pain in a way that is helpful, actually helpful.
Well, what's funny is, again, learning so much from this research and then my own experience, it was sort of just then all validated. And one thing that I never thought would have been helpful to people was offering hope because I'm such a pessimist. And yet hope, when I was going through my diagnosis, was very useful. But as Emily, I love this. She wrote this line in the book.
This is
my co-author.
Emily McDowell.
Yeah. She had this line. And something that you found on the internet does not count.
No. As hope.
Yes.
What if it's a cartoon?
Let's, you know, it's realistic founded hope. Because not all things do work out for the best. And so being hopeful but not being unrealistic and not denying the fear that somebody has. Also, expressing, rather than giving advice on what somebody could or should do, saying, I have faith in you. People feel very confused and often very inadequate with either how they're grieving, what should I be doing, when should I be over this, to what medical advice should I be trusting, how do I handle divorce questions. Lots of doubt. And instead of saying what you could do, saying, I trust you to make the right decision means so much to people. Also, I love you. It really can't be said enough. If it's not someone you love, but who you admire, I admire you. When people hear that they are loved or admired, when they are not feeling lovable or admirable, that's when it really, really counts. Not saying, however, you're doing such an amazing job, I could never do this.
That's a no-no.
That's a no-no.
Why is that?
Because, for example, you know, parents with a child with a disability hear this a lot. I just don't know how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's amazing. I could never do that. God bless you. And that feels like that's such a horrible situation. I could never imagine being in that situation. That would never happen to me. You are just in this whole other category of life. And that actually feels a lot like pity.
Or judgment.
Or judgment. So admiring what somebody is bringing to their situation, their tenacity, their open-mindedness, their acceptance, when you really see it, is super valuable. But not just imposing some superhero standard on someone just because they're in a crap situation that you'd never want to be in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm like giving you all my personal questions. These are all the things that I want to know for myself. So I hope this is useful to everyone listening as well. How do you know if somebody wants to talk? I mean, that's the other thing is.
That's such a hard one, right?
Right? I have a friend who, when my dad was sick, said, I wish that you could wear one of those do not disturb signs so that I could know, like, ask or don't ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's so brilliant. Yeah. I mean, what if there was some sort of ring or something I could wear that's like, red, I'm not willing to talk about it right now. Green, bring it on. But we obviously can't.
Right.
I guess we could. Marketing idea. Anyway, how do you feel out when somebody is willing or able to talk about a situation?
Well, you know, one thing I say in my talks or in my workshops is that grievers are mercurial creatures. And C.S. Lewis, who wrote a memoir on grief, who lost his wife. To paraphrase, he said, "I see people approach me wanting to ask how I am. I hate it when they do, and I hate it when they don't."
Yes, that is exactly it.
So there is no perfect win. There's no perfect time to ask how someone is doing. It's not always going to land right. There are some general rules of thumb. If someone's in a crisis, you've just been diagnosed with breast cancer, you're telling your friend the next day, instead of asking, "How are you?" ask, "How are you feeling right now? Right now. How are you today?" There was, and I bring this up in the book, a couple that I learned about whose baby had died of SIDS. They had a lot of family staying at their house, and they did put up a sign on their door that said, of a number of things that they didn't want people to do, "Please don't ask how we are." So in a moment of crisis, you don't necessarily need to ask that question. You can just ask how somebody's feeling in that moment. You may not know if that person wants to talk to you about it. More often than not, what I heard was people wanting to be asked. If it's a friend, I would err on the side of asking. And you may have to ask twice. So you may ask, for example, "How are you doing now that this is happening? You know, it's been a couple of months. What's it feel like?" And she may say, "I'm fine. It's good." And you may say, "Yeah, because I, you know, you totally cool. I just wasn't sure because I just wanted to know." Some way to say, "No, I really want to know." What people find when they're in a difficult time, and you may have found this with your dad's loss, that when people ask you, they often don't really want to know. So when you do give a real answer and then they say, that's my floor on the elevator, got to catch the bus, or you can tell that they really got to go or don't really want to hear it, you start to shut down and you don't start expressing yourself. So I think being that person that's like, "No, I'm really in a space where I really want to know," I would err on that side. Not asking every single time you see them. They don't want their difficult time to be a perennial source of conversation. So that's also something to cue into. And over time, bring up your own problems. So you could feel really self-conscious bringing up your 10-pound weight gain and that you can't fit your pants anymore when your friend's bald with chemo. Like, I get this is not the biggest problem in the universe. But it's my problem today and you're my friend. And that's really, really important. So there's ways to check in with people and convince them that you really do want to know how they're doing while not suggesting that they are now this whole category of affliction and there's nothing else about them that interests you except their tragedy.
Right. So finding that balance as their friend.
And looking for cues, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, if you ask somebody twice, you say, "No, really, are you sure you're okay?" And they say, "Yeah, thanks for asking." That's usually what you'll hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I personally experienced, and I wonder if you noticed this as you did your research and have talked with people over time, is that my personality, and I don't know if I contribute it to being as a woman, you know, who's trying to be successful in their career and appear not to be overly emotional or overly fazed by terrible things that happen.
God help me.
Mm-hmm. The tendency is to just power through
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, I've got my kids, I've got my job, I've got my friends. I don't want to make this a big deal for people. I, you know, we've had the conversation, you know, people have been incredibly helpful. but I'm going to demonstrate that I can make it through this. You know, and in part, that's a coping mechanism. And in part, I think it's actually defraying my ability to cope.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And anyway, I just was wondering if you have observed that for yourself or in others that you've talked with as this being a particularly female thing.
Mm. No, I don't think it is particularly female. I think men really have a hard time. And in fact, from the men that I interviewed, their male friends really rarely checked in with them. So it's even more pronounced. And even yourself, I mean, your loss happened in February?
He was diagnosed in February and he died in April. It was really fast.
So it's really, really common to power through for the first number of months. That's a very common response. And there is a lot to power through. And in a way, thank God.
Right.
And sometimes it's the firsts that get you by surprise. The first Father's Day. Some firsts. You're going into a store that you always went into with him. So these are things where it just comes unsuspecting. And there's no normal timeline for that. And in some ways, it's beautiful because then you're also, they're still with you. Sometimes the hardest part of grief is that feeling that you've forgotten. So I think it's something to really hold on to and not criticize yourself about.
Yeah, it was described to me as something coming in waves, and that is and at the most unexpected times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I've brought it up, so now you can hear it in my voice that it's hitting me. But yeah, it's the interesting question for me is, you know, how many times can I say something to my husband like, "Oh, I'm feeling really bad today about my dad." You know, before he gets like, can we just move on with this? Which I don't think he ever would, but I sort of feel self-conscious about being the initiator of the conversation.
That's why it is so important for good friends to keep asking, because they may fear, I don't want to bring up her dad because she may not have been thinking about it. Now I'm bringing up this sad topic. But you're always thinking about it on some level. And if you're not, and somebody asks you, what you first notice is, thanks for thinking about me. So I think to anyone who wants to be supportive, regular check-ins are really, really important, and noticing firsts. And then you feeling bad for it still being on your mind, it is going to be on your mind. There will be a time when it's not on your mind all the time anymore, and that's going to be really good too. One thing, you know, you talked about yourself being a fairly driven person, and I was too. You know, I did PhD, Peace Corps, lots of pretty good career stuff, all while sort of pummeling through sort of obviously the level of grief I felt around my loss that I didn't acknowledge, even to myself. And sometimes something comes along in our life. It's not always the first time. It's not always the first loss. Maybe it's the fifth or this fifth traumatic event that finally kind of brings us to our knees about the timeline and that we can't project manage everything and that we do not have as much control as we think we do. And if we believe we are supposed to have control, there can be a lot of shame for feeling out of control.
Well, when you were going through your breast cancer diagnosis and treatment, how did you ultimately reach out for help? How did you find your way to doing that for yourself?
For reaching out, you know, it's so funny. I just really resist talking about reaching out for help. Because I think it's just super, super hard to do in that situation. So you can sort of recognize the gifts that people have and ask them to do that for you and believe that actually people do want to help and that they are literally fretting at the sidelines wondering what they can do. So if you tell them what they can do, that would be wonderful. But your best bet is to have a project coordinator person do all of that assigning of tasks and things for you. I would say, though, that along with all the practical things that someone could do, from childcare to gardening to in breast cancer, driving you to chemo and just coming by and giving you company. I mean, those are all things that you can schedule. But I think what you also get struck with, I don't know if this happened with you, is just the spontaneous gifts that happened. Somebody leaving you your favorite donut at the office, or somebody bringing by flowers, just leaving them at the door. Somebody who you never knew even noticed you, really, asking you how you're doing. And you could tell they really wanted to know. Those sort of spontaneous moments, I think, are some of the ones that make you recognize there's this whole layer to humanity that requires some openness to connection and to noticing and to receiving. And that is sort of that kind of sense of being awoken to that. And then wanting to maintain that a little bit. It's sort of a milestone in human development. Like you said, you know, before this happened to me, I didn't realize what I was not doing. And you're going to be different now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, yeah. And those moments of spontaneity were probably the best.
Right?
Yeah.
Where it's
I
just
did get,
like...
I did get donuts on my doorstep.
You did?
I did. And, you know, and I had a wonderful weekend with friends away because they said, what can I do? And I said, take me to your country house.
Yes, really. Anyone with a country house, yeah. Just offer that up.
Yeah, I played that grief card really well for that one. But the other thing that it makes me think of is, so this sudden awareness and being open to connection and realizing that those extra things that you can do for people really do mean a lot. The things that you might not feel like you had time for.
Exactly.
You know,
I used to think, like, before, I mean, so with my mom, again, I really was not aware of my needs. I was sort of ignorant, and that's what led me to do the research. So I wasn't like, oh, I had this traumatic loss when I was 19. I became this wonderful helper. That did not happen. I instead just became powering through my life, which was great. A lot of great things came of it. But with the breast cancer diagnosis, all of these wonderful things happened. And that was my validation of the data and my recognizing it does not take very long to leave somebody a donut at their door. Recognizing, for example, I'm a horrible cook. Cooking for somebody else gives me a lot of stress. If that's the thing that I'm going to offer to somebody, it doesn't feel very good to me. They're going to get it with a lot of caveats about how bad the food is and apologies for me coming an hour late and on and on. But what I do love to do is buy flowers. I really love to buy flowers. I can take 15 minutes to put together a bouquet that's fun for me to do and leave it at somebody's door. I can do that. And so you realize, like, I actually have more time for this human connection than I thought I did, because you realize you don't have to heal anybody with these gestures. You just show that you notice and you care. And the multiplicity of people doing that is what gets people through.
I think the other thing that you mentioned earlier, that you can't project manage your life, or you can't control how long this project of life is really going to last, right? And for you, it seems to me that you kind of had a career switch
as a
result of this major event in your life being a diagnosis of breast cancer. And I just want to acknowledge that and talk about that for a minute as far as, you know, why the shift was important to you and why maybe it took this event for you to be able to do it when maybe otherwise you would not have.
Yeah. That switch did not come easy for me. I really had sort of a plan, which involved, you know, doing public policy work, getting really good at it, making great decisions and all of it. And yet this pull to do something around this work kept tugging at me. And I then straddled careers to do it. I stopped a full-time job, but I did, and I do, continue to consult in the nonprofit sector and also do these workshops and wrote the book and teach at San Jose State. So cobbling together activities so that I could manifest this work. And I'm definitely now at a point, it's out there, it's making a difference. I'm really, really, really grateful for that. I've had so much healing myself for having done this and listened to the universe that, yeah, which was saying a very different thing than my rational project manager side was to submit. And yeah, so now I am wondering about my next step. Do I return back to that life or not? I don't know.
Well, so many of the pieces of advice that you give in this book, I feel like are applicable beyond the terrible, awful things that happen. Mm. And just thinking about it, you know, being a parent of two, one teen, one tween, and the conversations that I have with them and the ability to withhold my extremely strong desire to give them all of my worldly advice could be tempered by some of what you shared in this book. I feel like it's got legs, as they say.
You know? I'm so glad. Yeah. No, I have had, because there have been a number of people that have gone through my trainings, a number of them in the Bay Area. So I'll hear from them through email or sometimes run into them. And it's amazing how often people say that, especially around parenting, because they're just, the rules are super simple. They're easy to remember the way that I think we talk about them in the book. And they are very basic. Like, yeah, very few of us want advice. And it is a lot easier to give advice than it is to listen. But it's not always what's most needed.
So what's the best advice that you've ever been given about not giving advice?
Don't give it. That people don't want your advice unless it's explicitly being asked for. And myself, I now, even when somebody asks me, unless I truly have like some informed advice, you know, not just some half-ass opinion, I say, if I had something, I would give it to you. And then just let them keep talking.
All right. Well, Kelsey, thank you so much.
Oh, this has been a pleasure, Lauren. Thank you.
I recorded this interview with Kelsey Crowe in 2017. I checked back with her this spring, and while a team of scholars study the impact of her work on long-term behavior change, she herself is teaching and she's collaborating with a team of empathy wunderkinds to bring empathy training to education for teacher wellness and into the workplace. Kelsey is the author of There Is No Good Card for This: What to Say and Do When Life is Scary, Awful, and Unfair to People You Love. And she's the founder of Help Each Other Out, where you can find online empathy webinars and trainings. We'll put the links on our website at inflectionpointradio.org. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is how women rise up. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, Pandora, NPR One, all the places. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman leading change we should talk to? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, support our production with a tax-deductible monthly or one-time contribution. When women rise up, we all rise up. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Inflection Point Radio.
Follow us and join the Inflection Point Society, our Facebook group of everyday activists who seek to make extraordinary change through small daily actions. And follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. To find out more about today's guest and to be in the loop with our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our community manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.